Is it possible that the mass shootings of scores of individuals during the October 1st concert in Las Vegas could have been faked? What key inconsistencies can be found in the way injured people were rescued and treated? What do we know about the alleged shooter, Stephen Paddock, and what can we make of his brother's confusing testimonials? Who was the prime beneficiary of the Las Vegas shootings? How did the Las Vegas attack compare with other mass shootings in recent history? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take an in-depth look at some of the anomalies and discrepancies at the heart of the official narrative of the three-week-old Las Vegas tragedy and try to make sense of what is and is not being discussed in the wake of what's been called the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history. Our guests are independent journalist and commentator Debbie Lusignan and 21st Century Wire staff writer and researcher Sean Helton. On this week's program, the Las Vegas shooting, cracks in the official narrative. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 20th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In his statement last week, Trump blamed Obama for having lifted nuclear sanctions on Iran, quote, just before what would have been the total collapse of the Iranian regime, unquote. After Netanyahu became Israeli Prime Minister in early 2009, his administration worked assiduously for 4 years to maneuver the Obama administration into giving Iran an ultimatum over its enrichment program. Obama rejected such a proposal, but Bolton has repeated his call for the United States to bomb Iran year after year. Now, the Trump administration is playing out a new chapter in the drama of the Likudists and their patrons in Washington. Their objective is nothing less than using U.S. power to weaken Iran through military means if possible and economic sanctions if necessary. That comes from the article, Donald Trump's Likudist Campaign Against Iran, by Gareth Porter, posted October 20th, originally appearing at The American Conservative. After Trump's October 13th announcement, the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany said in a joint statement that retaining the Iran deal, quote, is in our shared national security interest, unquote. They stated, quote, the nuclear deal was the culmination of 13 years of diplomacy and was a major step towards ensuring that Iran's nuclear program is not diverted for military purposes, unquote. Trump walks in lockstep with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has consistently opposed the Iran deal. The Christian Zionists who await Christ's second coming in Israel constitute a significant portion of Trump's base. That comes from the article, Trump and Netanyahu Walk in Lockstep on Iran, by Marjorie Cohn, posted October 20th. Washington, Israel, and its sinister AIPAC lobby resent Iranian sovereign independence, its military strength solely for defense, an obstacle to Israeli regional dominance, along with America's presence. Where Haley's hostile Wednesday remarks prelude for initiating diabolical Trump administration plans ahead, including naked aggression against the country, nuclear deal decertification a starter for what's to come. Haley called for tough Security Council action against Iran not forthcoming. Washington ignores international law, acting unilaterally or with rogue allies, pursuing its ruthless imperial agenda. Does it include war on North Korea and Iran? That comes from the article, Neocon Nikki Haley's Anti-Iran Rage, Prelude to War, by Stephen Ledman, posted October 20th. It is always possible that President Trump could destroy the U.S.-Iran agreement on an impulse and even, much more serious, pick a quarrel with the Revolutionary Guards. But it is more probable that he will once again act up in order to soothe his Israeli and Saudi allies. We have to keep in mind that Donald Trump is not a professional politician, but a real estate promoter, and that he acts like one. He gained his professional success by spreading panic with his outrageous statements and observing the reactions he had created amongst his competitors and his partners. In order to decide between these two hypotheses, we will have to wait for sanctions against the Revolutionary Guard. Then we shall see whether or not they are serious or simply an expression of Donald Trump's manner and the traditional masquerade of the United States against Iran. That comes from the article, Should U.S. Policy Against Iran Be Taken Seriously? By Thierry Maissan, translated by Pete Kimberly, posted October 20th, originally appearing at VoltaireNet.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On the evening of October 1, 2017, a single gunman, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, from his 32nd floor room at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, supposedly fired multiple rounds of ammunition at attendees of the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival half a kilometer away, managing to kill 58 and injure hundreds. A number of skeptical accounts have begun to surface on the internet and some independent media discrediting this narrative. One such account was from Debbie Lusignan. I interviewed her recently about her investigation. Debbie Lusignan is an activist and commentator on social media who goes by the handle Sane Progressive. She regularly puts out video essays in which she expertly deconstructs many of the false media narratives that surround contemporary political discourse. In recent weeks, she's devoted significant resources exploring the Las Vegas mass shooting, and has come across some interesting findings that I believe our listening audience needs to confront, especially if they've been enraptured by the mainstream and social media reporting on the incident. So here she is joining us from her home in Adams, Massachusetts. Hello, Debbie, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Michael. What a lovely introduction, and it is a pleasure, as always, to be speaking with you.
I guess I just wanted to start, first of all, I know that there's a specific aspect that you've chosen to focus on, and that having to do with some of the just basically a lot of the victim narratives and this just the depiction of the sheer magnitude of the devastation and the tragedy that's being presented, as opposed to some of the more commonplace narratives around multiple shooters and some of the background of the alleged assassin. So I'm just wondering if you might want to explain how you came to that specific focus, as opposed to the more kind of forensic type questions that I mentioned, which you seem to see as something of a distraction.
Yes, gotcha. Well, I guess I should tell you how I started to look at this story. When I first started to look at the footage coming out of Vegas, both the amateur footage coming from the crowd and what they were showing on the mainstream media, I noticed that what they were saying, the official narrative, that 59 people and 60 with the alleged shooter committing suicide, 60 people murdered and near 600 people shot with an automatic rifle or machine gun weapon. And I looked at the footage and I was looking at clip after clip after clip after clip, and I'm like, I'm not seeing what they're saying I'm seeing. I'm just not seeing it. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's footage I haven't seen, but I'm not seeing it. And immediately that just put my radar up. You'd see things like people falling over, you'd see blood, you know, after people were hit, you'd hear for cries for help, you'd hear cries for ambulances, just nothing was there. So I went forward and basically reviewed every bit of amateur footage I could find, mainstream media footage I can find, even the leaked stage footage, or what I very, very much believed to be stage footage. And there is no evidence, public evidence, if you actually examine it, that matches the official narrative. So I started to go, and I was following that angle. Then I started to look at the rescues, which was another thing that made no sense to me. What we saw was not rescues by ambulance, medevac helicopter, fire trucks, firefighters, police officers. What you did see, such as a clip that I included in one of the videos over on my BitChute channel, is you see rescues by stolen pickup trucks or commandeered pickup trucks in scenes with victims being rescued in wheelbarrows and even clothing apparel carts and just making no sense. And if you look at those, if you look at the footage of this rescue, there is no blood. There's no blood on the ground. There's no blood on the victims. There's no blood on the rescuers. There's no blood. And so I followed through to look into the story of the pickup truck rescues. What I found, what I've come to believe is that this was not only, what the story around the shooter was fake, and the story around Paddock and Jesus Campos and all of the, the newly added witnesses of Stephen Schmuck. The real story is that this was a staged event. It didn't happen.
Maybe we could just drill down just on a couple of the examples. I mean, yes, there's just an avalanche of video testimony and eyewitness testimony. Interestingly enough, you said there's no blood, and yet you have so many of these eyewitnesses saying, "Oh, there's blood everywhere," and then talking
We're looking at what they're showing us.
The videos of alleged eyewitnesses, I guess.
I challenge anybody. Now, I have done a video over on BitChute, which I encourage people to watch, because you really need to review this and see this with your own eyes, because what you have is the media telling you you're seeing something that you actually never see. You don't see it. Mm-hmm. So, if you go over to my video on BitChute, I will give you the footage, not every bit, but I give you many links of the footage that was taken from the crowd of the people who were there. And you have people, and they are scanning the crowd with their cameras, and they're saying things like, "I don't see anybody actually injured. Those aren't real gunshots. You don't see people lying on the field. You don't see any blood. You don't see any shell casings. You just don't see it. What you do see is there is a video of people starting to run and file out before the gunshots started to be heard in the crowd. They Don't Know song goes with Jason Aldean. I show you the video clip of that. Now, people have pointed out to me, they say, "Well, it's dark." It's like, okay, but you still don't see any of it in the video, but it is a little dark. You don't see people lying on the field. You also will notice when you listen, after the boom, and you hear the shots, you don't hear screams, cries of agony, cries for help. You hear silence. For the first initial fire, you hear silence, and then you hear silence. And then when the crowd figures out something's going on, then you hear a little bit of like, "Oh, run, run." But nobody hit, nobody falling over. And then if that's really not enough, and that really should be enough to get people's radar up. Then you look at the rescue scenes with no blood and no firefighters and no ambulances and no medevac helicopters. But what you do see is rescue by wheelbarrow and pickup truck. And, you know, and they're giving contradicting narratives, because there's a story in the Chicago Tribune where they're literally saying that the firefighters, police, and medics were storming the field while the guns still fell, and police were forming this protective bubble, and they ran in to get the victims while the bullets still fell. Of course, there's not an inch of footage of that. But everybody is rescued by pickup truck. Now,
They can get the pickup trucks in, but they can't get the ambulances in. I don't quite understand that.
Well, you want to hear a narrative that is just like, if you think that, I want you to hear the narrative of Taylor Winston.
Yes.
Taylor Winston is the lead pickup truck rescuer. Now, Taylor Winston allegedly stole a pickup truck from an adjoining parking lot, or it was lying around on the ground, because the stories are always inconsistent, but there's two versions of it. But in either case, the keys just happened to be lying in it, and Taylor Winston allegedly put 15 critically ill gunshot people at a whack into a Chevy Silverado. And if you listen to the stories around the victims that he rescued, they are not, they're literally impossible to be true, but that's a different part of it. But so he allegedly does this, shoves 15 critically wounded gunshot victims in the truck. And then, this is on Fox News, not only did he deliver them to the hospital and, you know, do that, he then decided, you can read this on his Facebook page, you can read this in all the articles, that he went back with his bloody pickup truck and drove back and then allegedly got 15 more victims and brought them back and then went back for a third trip. That story is a lie. The first version of the story of him leaving with 15 victims is utterly hard to fathom. But how in the world would somebody drive in with a pickup truck covered in blood? How would he ever get back on the scene? How would the police and the ambulances ever allow him to pick up critically wounded people? And if they had not gotten care by that time, they'd be dead. But yeah. This is the story.
There's also, it's strange because, like, usually in incidents like this, or even something like a political demonstration, I mean, there are people who have some sort of insignia on them to indicate that they're medics or they're rescue people or something. But this guy, I don't know, just somehow, maybe it's his charisma, I don't know, he has somehow is able to get away with transporting all these people this way. Another kind of funny story, and I don't want to dwell too much, but the one of Christina Kitkat, which is quite an interesting story. I mean, somebody who was shot and rescued, and but you know they didn't take the boyfriend didn't take her to the ambulance. He took straight to his car and then to the hospital.
Christina Kitkat is somebody people really want to look at. Christina Kitkat is allegedly was shot in the heart and hit her left ventricle. According to the reports coming out, and you can verify this is all over the mainstream media, she had four holes in her heart, holes in her lungs. Her boyfriend rescues her in a beer cart and then brings her to Taylor Winston's pickup truck, bypassing the ambulances allegedly on the scene. And that report is like, people say there's no ambulances on the scene, but this report says there's ambulances on the machine. But anyways, so this, they want us to believe a woman that is directly hit in the heart and the lungs by automatic gunfire. Not only, since she's rescued in a pickup truck, she remains conscious the entire ride to the hospital. And then when they get to the hospital, they put her in a wheelchair, and it's not nurses or doctors who provide care, but her rescuers who apply a EKG and an oxygen mask. I don't know how you're going to get any oxygen on a respiration system that is filled with blood and lungs have collapsed and most likely in cardiac arrest. And then they wheel her away. It's all Hollywood drama. It's very poorly done. The stories make no logical sense. And all of the victims that are the survivors, the alleged survivors, every last one of them was either rescued in a pickup truck or even an Uber.
Yeah. Yeah, Debbie, could you talk a little bit about some of the investigation you've done into who these people were? You know, the like when you started investigating, you know, the alleged victims and looking into their backgrounds. Are there anything that really stood out? Any patterns that seemed to keep presenting themselves when you dug deeper into their, you know, whether it's their Facebook profiles or anything that was available through the major media?
Well, let me just finish my thought on this, and then it'll transition nicely into what you just asked. Now, remember, why are you seeing all of these victims being rescued, not getting trauma care, but being brought in pickup trucks in multiple loads, 15 in a whack, and Ubers? Well, real EMTs would notice if these people didn't have bullet wounds. Also should be noted that, according to the reporter on CNN, no hospitals allowed anybody in that night. They said that even family members were being turned away, because the big question for everybody is always, there's too many people who would know. That's what people say. How do they fake it? How do they fake it? So things that people need to keep in mind, and then I'll get into talking about what you're saying. Witness testimony from that night was, all the exits were closed and everybody was corralled out of one exit. You'll see that in multiple interviews of people who are doing the investigation, the alternative media. So everybody would have been removed from the scene immediately. And so, you know, they heard the gunshots, they heard the simulated fire, they heard everybody running. So most people were out of there. If you watch the footage, they left very quickly. So, you know, that's taken care of. You don't have real rescue workers. You don't have anybody, any hospitals, anybody being witnesses at the hospitals. And then who would they fake it? How would they fake the victims? And when I started looking into the profiles, you know, Christina KitKat was the one that really tipped me off. So I started to look at the people surrounding her. And so I looked at her GoFundMe manager's profile, a woman named Casey Napitolano. And this is all public. You can all go look at this on her profile. And I looked, and then I went to her page, which is over on Facebook, and I looked at her friends list, which was basically a who's who of low-level Hollywood actors and actresses, production companies, and makeup artists. And then I also started to look at histories of the victims, and there are people doing it. There's people over on LiveLeak who is doing a great series. If you search LiveLeak and you put in search for evidence Vegas shooting, this individual, you can go watch these videos for yourself, because this will give you a real idea of the issue around the victims. Is you look into the victims' profiles and you see that they don't live where they say that they live. They're at a different city at a different address. Lot of aliases. You see a lot of aliases for these people's names. If you look up their work addresses, it'll tell you that they work somewhere. They do not work. There's no record of employment, or they supposedly have a law office or some kind of an office set up, and there's no office. If you look at the building register, there's not tenants in that building. And and I really would recommend going to watch that over on LiveLeak, because this person actually shows you this. They go and they show you the aliases. They show you the different addresses and all of that. And this is consistent. You don't just see this for one or two people where you might get some weirdness. It's across the board with no matter who you search.
There's an interesting point that you raise about like one of the differences between this incident and 9/11 was that with 9/11 you had the families being in your own words a pain in the ass, the 9/11 Jersey girls and the different families, because they were making a lot of noise and you know in this instance. Who are the victims' families coming forward, making demands about, you know, things not adding up, and instead we have somebody, you know, this Jesus Campos guy showing up on Ellen. So I'm just wondering, like, what if you could, you know.
Well, people, that's a very legitimate question that a lot of people ask me. Okay, Debbie, you know, the things you're saying are making a lot of sense. My viewers have, you know, like, I looked at your evidence. Okay, you're making sense. You're making sense. But the thing that everybody asks is, what, you know, these people are criminals. They don't, obviously don't have a problem with killing people. Why would they go to this trouble? And I really do think it's exactly what you just said, Michael. The victims' families are a royal pain in the ass. If you actually have 600 people shot, their lives destroyed, their lives ruined, and or people murdered, you have families who are going to want answers. It is the relatives, it is the families of 9/11 that are the reason that we even got the sham of an investigation into 9/11 at all. We wouldn't have had an investigation. They got Henry Kissinger kicked off. They appointed another sham investigator, but they were the thorns in their side, and they're still their thorns in the side. 16 years later, they are still running websites and touring to get the truth out about 9/11. Hmm. So, you know, yes, it's going to be a pain in the ass and it's going to be difficult up front, but you don't have 17 years of families, you know, making it their life's work to expose how the government actually works. So that is my hunch about why they go in this direction. And I think there's going to be false flags where you're going to see actual real murders and false flags where they're not. I still refuse to say that absolutely nobody was harmed or injured in this incident, but I am not seeing any real evidence of any gunfire, any real evidence that this occurred. It looks like a simulated event. I just don't even know, once you review the evidence and actually look at the stories they're trying to tell, how you can continue to believe that this is real. Mm. In fact, I think the only thing, the only thing that's holding this together is a public that is not actually reviewing what is publicly available to look at, and the cognitive dissonance and the fear about what is real and what is actually happening, and the fear of moving forward and admitting that this is what is actually happening with in our country right now.
I think we're just about at the end of our allotted time, but I want to use this as an opportunity to kind of plug the video that YouTube won't allow you to disappeared from YouTube, but you have it on a site. It's called bitchute.com, and you got a 2-hour expose there, and I do encourage our listeners and readers to go and check it out, where you lay all of this information out there, as well as a very interesting conversation about cui bono. And I think that's, and there's also like all of your videos, it's, you document all and chronicle all the links, so you back up everything that you have to say. Debbie, unless you have some parting words, I think we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you.
This time, Michael, thank you for having me on.
So we've been speaking with Debbie Lou Signan. She is the Sane Progressive. You could check out her YouTube channel. And as I mentioned, check out her expose at bitchute.com. And I guess you could just plug Sane Progressive in the search engine and you should find it.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Sean Helton is a writer, researcher, and associate editor with 21st Century Wire. He's probed the details of the Las Vegas mass shooting along with other mass shootings in recent U.S. history. He recently composed a synthesis of his findings in an October 12th article entitled "The Las Vegas Mass Shooting: More to the Story Than We've Been Told." He joins us now from Phoenix, Arizona. Great to have you on the show, Sean.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me. Great opportunity. Appreciate it.
Okay, now, As probably most of our listeners know, there are a number of anomalies in the official explanation, and I'm just wanted to get from you your take on any particular anomalies and discrepancies that you personally have chosen to focus on.
Yeah, there's in the article you mentioned, there's a whole framework of elements that questionable information surrounding the details of that particular mass shooting, whether it be the outfitting of cameras in the hotel room by the alleged gunman, Stephen Paddock, or exactly how he managed to even get this material, gear up towards his hotel room, or from the vantage point, how did he sort of, in terms of the reportage of many citizens as well as those online, many have suggested there might have been multiple shooters in this event. So there's a number of questions surrounding it. So the article goes into a lot of those different angles and, did my best to comprise in a compacted period of time, even though there was a tremendous amount of information about this case.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you mentioned the issue of the lone gunman scenario. And in this case, we have this elderly individual, Stephen Paddock. And, for a variety of reasons, it seems unlikely that he would have been acting alone. But could you give us some background on Mr. Paddock himself? I mean, because there's some interesting details about this individual, this guy who's apparently one of these high-stakes gamblers, and somebody who's apparently not had much military experience, or basically suddenly overnight becoming this major superstar, much more proficient than people who've been trained for years. So what do we know about Mr. Paddock?
Well, we're told that, according to reports, that, he was a avid, he liked to hunt, that he basically, in addition to that, he's a hunting enthusiast, a licensed pilot. He had an affinity for luxury cruise vacations, not at all the typical gunman profile that we are used to seeing, those who are analyzing this type of information on a regular basis. So this case presents some very peculiar anomalies associated with that. Now, Paddock himself doesn't appear to have any military training for weaponry per se that we know of, that's been released or acknowledged in any way. He does have a history of working for different government agencies in the 70s, working as an IRS agent from 78 to 84, also the U.S. Postal Service in the 70s, and then later on in the late 80s, working for the predecessor company of Lockheed Martin during the 80s, which the company did acknowledge, but they wouldn't specify on which specific company, whether it was Lockheed Corporation or Martin Marietta in 1995. So they merged in 1995. So they wouldn't specify which company he worked for in the 80s, and very limited information regarding that particular element of the case.
Of course, there's the unusual couple of unusual interviews with his brother, indicating that he was that he couldn't possibly have. Or that he could have done it, but that it wasn't quite in his nature. I mean, it was a really quite a bizarre interview. It just seems like an unusual for a family member to be saying these things. I mean, if they really believe that, it's not something that he would have done, but he could have done it, and they don't even seem to be calling for his, for a fair trial. So, do you have any thoughts about what some of the narrative coming from the people that supposedly know him so well?
Yeah, there seems to be a contradictory sort of element concerning his past, and you've heard reports of family members saying that He was a generous, kind man, and even his brother, Eric Paddock, even said that at some point during the first interview, I think, and even reiterated aspects of that in the second, but was always careful to inject the possibility that his brother may have been unhinged at the same time. So it seems like we have multiple narratives sort of overlapping each other in this particular aspect of the story, with the brother simultaneously trying to not necessarily, well, seemingly not incriminating his brother, while also seeming simultaneously incriminating him. So it seemed to be, there seemed to be an overlap in terms of that. Those interviews seem to be very baffling to those of us who analyze this stuff in terms of, you know, in terms of that part of the case, it seemed extremely theatrical to me. Now, I'm not really sure of Eric Paddock's background per se, but the sheer theatricality and spectacle of those interviews seemed to basically shoot an overview over the entire thing. In terms of his reaction, his emotional outbursts during the interviews, while of course in any tragedy, you're going to have these maybe conflicting emotions about things, and possibly maybe not the best idea to meet with media during a time of tragedy, if in fact you believe that your brother was a part of this. I'm shocked that he was so forthcoming with reporters about coming forward in this way, because if anything, it actually just seemed to add another bizarre, surreal element to the story instead of really explain anything.
Mm. Can you comment on the way you see information about the shooting being controlled, contained, distorted, and otherwise garrisoned? And if that's, you know, if there's anything new about the way it's being, you know, addressed with all the spotlight that's been on that event over the last, well, I guess it's a couple of weeks now.
Are you referring to the theories regarding multiple shooters and acoustic evidence?
Well, I mean, okay, let's just start with, for example, there have been timelines have been altered, like just over the course of the first handful of days. You know, can you comment on the significance of those changes?
Yeah, so the odd thing is with the timeline, and of course, Sheriff Joseph Lombardo suggested that it was not such a big deal that the timelines have changed. The reality is that, you know, barring any hyper speculation, I mean, it does significantly change the crime scene. I mean, we were told initially that Jesus Campos, the Mandalay Bay security guard who supposedly started working for them in June, was the hero star witness of this event. And Stephen Shook was also a second eyewitness to the shooter, alleged gunman Paddock. So in this frame, we were told that the shooting, before the concert mass shooting took place, we were told that Campos had gone up to the hotel, checked on a door alarm of some sort, and then had noticed the suite, or had been walking up the hallway and noticed something about the area, a door alarm nearby, and then Paddock opened fire on him, supposedly shooting 200 rounds out towards him inside the hallway of the Mandalay Bay on the 32nd floor. Now, this would have caused a tremendous amount of damage. Not only would have been damage, but it would have been extremely loud, likely resulting in many 911 calls from anybody who had been in the vicinity of this particular shooting. And so far, we've seen a very scant, if anything, really coming from the 32nd floor. There, so far, from what I can surmise, there hasn't been a single 32nd floor eyewitness other than the two security guards who've come forward publicly to state anything about this event, which is a very shocking, strange thing when you're considering this is the most deadly U.S. Mass shooting in modern U.S. history. So when we're thinking of these things, you know, that part of it is a huge element when you're looking at the timeline. So they presented this detail that Campos was the one who was that sort of stopped or maybe slowed down the tragedy itself. And then they reversed the details a couple days later to suggest that he was shot earlier, and then the concert mass shooting had begun at 10:05. He was shot potentially at 9:59. They claimed this was an error, a manual error that was written in. It was not to be discussed in this way. Lombardo came forward basically suggesting that that was an error and that the mainstream media and alternative media alike had gotten that part of the story wrong, and that basically sort of shifted blame back on those who are analyzing the case and maybe scrutinizing close details of this case, when in reality it was really the officials themselves, the FBI and the Las Vegas police, who struggled to create a timeline that made any sense. And then so they basically they reversed it and went back to the original story. But what's odd now, and I know Jesus Campos finally resurfaced recently after disappearing for a week or more, on the Ellen show, I haven't yet watched that interview, but I'm guessing that they're going to try to perpetuate a hero narrative again now. But the interesting thing here is they had shied away, and even Lombardo himself kind of shied away from mentioning him as a hero in this event once they changed the timeline details several times, because they basically went back to the original story, which was just strange and really kind of unprecedented in a case of this magnitude.
Mm. Now, there have been skeptical accounts that have been registered about whether the massacre even happened or whether it happened to the extent that it did. I mean, there's been references to crisis actors and they all using the same talking points about blood everywhere and it was like a war zone. And of course, you're talking about shots from a quarter mile away, and the idea that that there was this blood fest, and then these eyewitnesses keep talking about it. But I guess I'm just wondering, like, because I know you've been quite diligent about the being careful about the points that you would want to raise in a public discussion about this. Is there any doubt? Is there any serious question in your mind about the type and the number of casualties that have come forward? I mean, could the scale of the crisis be far smaller than the official account?
You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, I think at this point, there are a lot of multiple angles to look at that. It's hard to sort of commit to one side or the other. I feel that this particular mass shooting displays hallmarks of a very sophisticated dynamic that suggests both real aspects, very real aspects of people being injured and killed, and also potentially fake or even crisis actor-like scenarios. I think it was a mixture of things that were going on in this particular event, and it was a highly orchestrated, highly choreographed event that really, I feel undoubtedly that it couldn't have been just one person who would have been responsible for this event. The level of coordination of the different eyewitness accounts, many of them dovetailing what you're suggesting. I have seen some of the footage of some of these people being interviewed and put in front of cameras on media who have accounts basically discussing almost exact details, but in a very cold, sort of sterile, even disconnected way. I have seen some of that footage, but I've also heard real stories, which seem to me to be very real. And, in this particular event, I'm aware of at least a few people who were even at that event. So personally, so I know that there are real and maybe manufactured elements to this case. So that's, in terms of the numbers, I don't know. I wouldn't be able to speculate on what was real, what wasn't real. I think we're just starting to sift through a lot of that stuff, but we may never know. We may never know the exact number of injured. We may never know the exact number of killed. Many of these particular events, and I've covered a lot of these over the years, seem to the event seems so complex in terms of breaking down the various background elements of details, the characters involved, that whether or not victims are real sometimes becomes a a rabbit hole in a sense that people go down that is, I don't want to say is not fruitful in terms of figuring out the crime itself, but becomes a bit more of an obsession than maybe detailing elements of the crime that could expose larger, maybe black operation elements of the crime or potentially false flag elements of a crime, where you can show historical references. And I try to use and contextualize that kind of element in my reports always with these types of shootings, because it's important for people to always go back to that historical reference points, those different various reference points, to see that these things have occurred throughout history, and that those things are worth looking at to potentially solve a crime.
I'm wondering if you could put the October 1st tragedy in the context of other mass shootings that you've studied and that have taken place in the last decade or so. Is there a pattern that has emerged about who the perpetrators are and how and why these events unravel the way they do?
Well, as far as I can tell in terms of what I've done research-wise, there seems to be varying crisis management teams involved in either prior to many of these shootings occurring, many of these high-profile shootings. And even in Las Vegas, the case of Las Vegas, there seems to be, I believe it's called the Readiness Group. It's a former FBI agent who started it, and I'm not remembering his name at the moment. But basically, I look for clues in media reports early on, and I didn't write about this in that first report or any subsequent reports since then, but it's definitely something I'll consider going back to if I really do an even bigger analysis of this particular event. That particular group had to comment, that crisis management group commented shortly after the shooting, and I know that they work very closely with MGM Resorts. So I thought that was interesting, and I've noticed a pattern with some of these events in the past that some of the people who often are a part of these crisis management teams seem to chime in shortly after a disaster has taken place. If you go back and look at some of those cases, and I have some of it documented at Global Research and other places, and of course at 21st Century Wire, but you know, it's one of those things that I've definitely noticed that there are sometimes elements that security-wise that are developing in this country, that's the pattern I see, is the overt push for securitization of this country, whether it be police state or surveillance equipment, body scanners, that type of thing. This usually ushers in that kind of stuff. But of course, the usual calls for gun control and things of that nature to sort of get people emotionally divided on that issue over a tragedy. But I do find it very odd that these particular crisis management companies seem to chime in right near or after an event very often when you're looking at reports. And it's stuff that most people might miss if they're not really looking for that.
I find that there's a tendency, at least among some independent media, to jump to the conclusion that, it's a false flag. They're trying to bring in gun control. And they start mm-hmm. looking at the incidents like this through that lens. Is there any danger associated with that kind of approach to trying to dissect an incident like such as this one?
Yeah. So, you know, while those could be potential issues to be concerned with, social, political issues that are, you know, the politicization of these mass shootings is definitely a very real thing. Now, how it's sort of being sort of pushed out there by certain media outlets. You know, some outlets will overzealously report elements of that, of those types of the crime, or that part of the crime that they think is occurring, or that narrative is occurring. But for me, you know, I look at that stuff as sort of background noise to the actual forensics of the crime. So, of course, those things maybe are concerning in the overall picture of the public. But there's always going to be a debate about that stuff. And then when you look at the gun sales after these events, they soar. Usually the stocks go up like crazy. There's a pattern that we've seen in many of these shootings. I think you could make the argument that sometimes these events really are actually very good for the gun industry. So I'm not suggesting that, meaning I support that. Of course, I don't support any of this. And any of this mass tragedy is a terrible thing for people to have to go through, whether real or manufactured psychological trauma. It's a terrible thing to have to endure. You know, it's just that I believe that there are financial and political interests that benefit from a divided public on socio-political issues concerning gun reform or security.
Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on the prime beneficiaries of this particular shooting?
Of this particular shooting?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I could speak to who are the beneficiaries of this particular event. I think you do need to look at why CEO Jim Murren was sort of thrown into the public eye over the the claim over the MGM stocks being sold off before the shooting. Now, that may very well have happened because Kip Herridge from the Wall Street firm that analyzes Wall Street data, I mean, he's a very credible source in Wall Street anyway, so it would seem unlikely that he would even comment about it if it wasn't something that actually occurred. I know that initially that claim came out of 4chan, and I think it's important to be skeptical of some of the information we see there and really scrutinize some of that information so we can get a better picture. But when we look at the MGM stock situation, it seemed to put Jim of Mandalay Bay into the frame, and we have to wonder why that is. Are there other people who would benefit from him taking the fall for this particular event in some kind of way, making him sort of the quote-unquote false flag fall guy for the Mandalay Bay shooting? I'm not suggesting that's what he is. I'm saying that meme, that alternative narrative has been put out there. But we should always treat any of these lines of narratives and storylines with skepticism and question all of these events in minute ways, too. And all these details should be questioned. Why would he be put in that frame? Why would he put himself in that light, given the circumstances of the nature of this crime? If he was involved, I'm not suggesting he is, if he was, why would he then publicly have traded a bunch of stocks beforehand to make a bunch of money when it makes it look like he took a financial benefit of this particular scenario? So to me, it seems like that could be more or less a red herring, and that's something that we should look closer at. It's important to note those details, that the stocks maybe were sold, but what was the reason why this particular company has been put in the frame in terms of, you know, taking the full responsibility of this event? Now, I know there's been a lot of speculation, and there's a lot of Twitter noise, I'll say, out there in social media about elements of Mandalay Bay and the level of security. But we should also be dubious right now in this country, in America. There's a lot of far-left people who benefit politically, and there's a lot of far-right people now who are benefiting politically from these kinds of events. And then these channels come up and different websites pop up who seem to have all the answers about these crimes and who might be perpetrating them, and whether it's so-and-so takes responsibility. And we should be very dubious of these claims. And websites that kind of push these strong, heavily circumstantial narratives, if there's any evidence at all. So to me, it seems very odd that they would be pushing these angles that haven't been proven in any way. And it's a quick way to shorten your career as a journalist, in my opinion, if you're going to take really strong narratives of a subject and not scrutinize the minutiae and the behind the scenes to really get closer to maybe a better overview of what actually took place.
Finally, Sean, I was wondering if you could speak to your appraisal of the way media, both mainstream and alternative or independent, have been reporting or not on this event. Well, what stands out for you?
Well, you know, it's a strange case. This was unlike many other shootings. So this is a very hard piece case to compare to a lot of other shootings. Although there are some things that we're seeing now kind of popping into frame. It's not, there's a lot of stuff out there, I believe, that is designed to confuse the public. And I don't want to criticize any one outlet, but I think that we have to look at things like certain outlets, whether it be mainstream media or alternative media, pushing terror narratives without any validity or any proof. When you look at who put that particular meme out there, the person who usually puts those memes out is site intelligence, they're very entrenched with the CIA and very often have their own narrative to push politically.
They're the ones that come out with the bin Laden videos, right?
Yes. All the heavily doctored Al Qaeda videos that we've seen over the years, that even the whole Bell Pottinger situation where the Pentagon paid for $500 million worth of fake terror videos. They've been involved in that spectrum of dissemination of information when it comes to propaganda. So we should always be dubious of where these claims come from. And when media outlets then take that first run of where that first narrative went, and then go whole hog behind that particular idea, I think it's a dangerous place to put yourself in from an analyst point of view, because you're not able to really see it with open eyes. You're not able to really clearly dig inside the crime because you've already basically put a particular narrative on it. It painted it with a particular narrative that you can no longer get out of that particular framework of thinking, and it becomes more about, say, the story of terror or illegal aliens, because now there's a question about whether Campos is really Campos and his social security number. And I'm not suggesting I believe in these reports wholeheartedly. I think it's important to look at that information and see it for what it is, but also look at the political interest putting that information out, the media outlets that are pushing that particular element of the story. Are they serving their own interests, or are they trying to solve a crime? I think that's the question that people should ask.
Well, Sean Helton, we really appreciate your thoughts on this topic. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your views with our listeners.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. It was great to be here, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
For sure. We've been speaking to Sean Helton. He's a writer, researcher, and associate editor with 21st Century Wire. He recently authored the article, The Las Vegas Mass Shooting, More to the Story Than We've Been Told, which is now posted on the Global Research website. You can read more of his archived work at the site 21stcenturywire.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.